Remind me, are we still clapping with this, or does this obviate the clap?
We can do the clap, but it's just for fun now.
The clap is always fun.
Now we have the clap. Okay, and now I'm going to...
Are you all too young to know the clap?
No, we know about
Everybody
the clap.
Knows the clap. Okay. Come on.
Wait, which clap?
Some things don't age. We have the venereal disease.
Oh. No, it's a specific venereal disease.
Yeah, it's chlamydia, right?
It's syphilis.
No.
Syphilis?
Oh, syphilis?
I think it's syphilis.
It's totally syphilis.
I always heard it was chlamydia because of the... discharge of the sailor. My dad told me growing up, thanks dad, that the sailors would get such bad discharge that they'd be crusty and then they'd whack their against the deck.
No, but that's wrong because chlamydia is pretty asymptomatic in men, right?
I think it's gonorrhea. I think it's gonorrhea.
To be honest, I may have been just trying so hard not to think about it that I...
Google says gonorrhea for what Google it's worth.
Yeah. You know, there's like a super resistant strain of gonorrhea now. It's like on the CDC like watch list of like drugs. Yeah. It's crazy.
So what's the deal with this super gonorrhea?
You're supposed to use like a higher dose of, I forget what drug. Some drug, like a higher dose because it's getting like super resistant. Anyway, it's kind of interesting, but.
You have to hit your thing even harder.
I didn't realize we had to.
We had to
start by recording that crazy thing we say for the intro part of the podcast. But I feel like we totally did that right on cue with the which clap is which STD.
Renal physiology, a complex yet logical and internally consistent system that maintains our precious bodily fluids. You are listening to a counting of our two-year mission. We're thinking that we're going to need to actually extend this out to 4 years, but we'll see, to explore and develop a functional mental model of the workings of the kidney and its associated functions. To understand completely how the kidney accomplishes its primary mission of establishing and maintaining homeostasis. This is Channel Your Enthusiasm, the Burton Rose Cocktail Club and Variety Hour. My name is Joel Toff, and I'll be your host tonight. Tonight, we are discussing the exciting conclusion to Chapter 14. We only have a few pages left that we were unable to finish last month, but this time we've got the full crew. JC?
Hello, Juan Carlos Velez, nephrologist at Ochsner in New Orleans.
Roger.
Roger Rodby, nephrologist, Rush University Medical Center, Chicago.
Melanie.
Melanie Honig, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Boston, Massachusetts.
Letty.
Letícia Rolón, nephrologist at UCSF.
Award-winning nephrologist at UCSF. That's a congratulations.
I got the Holly Smith Award.
Do you know who Holly Smith was?
Yeah, he was an internist. He did.
I would have never guessed the gender. I would have gone totally the other way.
Yeah.
Holly, okay.
There's like in the new med school, there's a new building, and they did a whole wall in remembrance of him. And he was also credited with bringing, I think, Brenner, a rector here to UCSF. He was one of the deans of the School of Medicine, and was just very much loved teaching, and really set the culture of like collegiality and approach, you know, being approachable even in administration. And so he was also a researcher, I believe.
And what is there a stated reason for winning the award? Because you are approachable?
Yes, they said basically advancing the mission of UCSF to be like one of the greatest medical schools, and one of them is actually being social, because he was very social. So I guess I fit that very well.
And is it a nephrology specific award, or is it just in the Department of Medicine?
School of Medicine wide.
School of Medicine.
And they give it to two faculty and two staff.
Congratulations. That's outstanding. Well done.
Thanks.
Well done. Anna?
Anna Gaddy, nephrologist at Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.
Is there an aspirational award at the Medical College of Wisconsin you have your eye on?
Not that I know of. I've only been here, 8 or 9 months, and so I haven't really felt out what I'm going to shoot for yet. but I'll let you know.
Okay.
If we do the podcast long enough, maybe I'll win one.
Wow. Amy?
I'm Amy Yao. I'm a nephrologist at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center.
And Josh?
Josh Waitsman. I'm a nephrologist and scientist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And I'm pretty sure it's just a thrill just to get to be employed.
That's your award. That's the reward right there. Yeah.
After that long training journey, just having a job. That's great.
The other thing that I'm reminded of is in the original Star Trek series, when Shatner is giving his monologue, it's a 5-year mission. But then when they reboot the Next Generation, it's an ongoing mission. And so be careful, because I may change the monologue to an ongoing mission.
I thought it was like Gilligan's Island, right? The 3-hour tour. That was what was going through my head. But
now we are well beyond the 3-hour tour. And
we could have a 3-hour tour single episode at some point soon.
We are boldly going where no one's gone before. So
we are plowing forward. Okay. So even though Letty says we finished on 431, I'm going to make an executive decision. Move us to page 432, treatment.
Yes, don't listen to me.
Bold move. And Burton Rose, we are treating volume deficiency. As a reminder, that's what all of chapter 14 has been on. He says that both oral and IV treatment can be used for volume replacement, and that the goal of therapy is to restore normal volemia and to correct associated acid base and electrolyte disorders. And then the next paragraph is on oral therapy. And he says that that can be accomplished with increased water and dietary sodium. And then when you do that, he says one of the things you can add on is salt tablets. And I have never used salt tablets in the treatment of volume deficiency. Has anybody done this?
Not salt tablets, but you know, we use the oral rehydration packets. So I've used that when I've been abroad. I did a rotation abroad, and when we couldn't get saline bags, certainly we use those.
And tell me a little. So okay, I've never been abroad. I've only done medicine in the Midwest. So tell me about that experience a little bit.
Yeah, to be honest, it's a little bittersweet. It is a rotation that was set up. It's a global health rotation, but in many ways, it feels the risk of sounding controversial, a little self-serving. We certainly learn a lot more so than what we're actually able to contribute. We learn how to practice in a very resource limited setting. But
are you able to say where it is, or are you not comfortable saying?
Oh, that? Yeah, sure. Yeah, I went to Uganda. I was in Kampala. Mm-hmm. I was in Kampala. But we actually had a case. It was really unfortunate, of a pediatric patient with DKA, about 11 years old, who came in a DKA, as you know, many liters down. And this patient, the family actually has to bring in the saline bags for them to be hung. And because the floors are so busy, they fell behind. And actually, the patient passed.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So because they had bags, but there was nobody to actually come in and hang them. Each intern has a patient load of like 50 patients. It's crazy. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was insane. So this is where I saw that and actually carrying these, the WHO has oral rehydration packets, and it's really convenient. I mean, I think it's like $10 for 100 packs. And so it's really convenient. And you just put it, it tells you one packet per liter of water, and it gives you the same osmolality.
One packet per liter of water. Amy, you've used these?
Yeah, in the military, we use it quite a bit, actually. So when we're like doing training sessions or whatever, if you don't have access to start a saline drip or anything like that, or you know the medic doesn't start or whatever, then you can just take an ORS packet. The soldiers like to use it because they think it's like Gatorade, so they think it's really fun. But I have used it in a like austere environment for people who've had a lot of diarrhea. You just give them, tell them to do like an ORS like 3 times a day or something like that.
Well, I was a medical student still in Peru during the epidemic of cholera. So I had to go to help in the emergency department. And it's something that, like as Lady was describing, the World Health Organization has this solution that is 8 teaspoons of sugar and 1 of salt. That is sort of the ratio. Homemade solution, the ratio. And I think it's a combination of making it palatable and also, you know, sodium glucose reabsorption in the gut goes, you know, maybe use the co-transporter that we have.
Yeah, Rose, Rose mentions that very mechanism.
Correct. So that was the solution. And, you know, you mentioned that $10 $10 per 100 packets. Well, this was one Peruvian sol. It was as cheap as you can get. I'm telling you, probably 10 times cheaper than what you described. And, but, you know, the emergency department were, you know, they were packed with people, flooded with kids coming with cholera, and they were massively hydrated. And it was just literally impossible to manage all this population with intravenous fluid. So oral therapies were very important. And, you know, I knew very little about it at the time. I was just, you know, pushing stretchers in the emergency room and helping the residents do the work. But yeah, that was a very common therapy at that time.
Now, you know, some sodium is better than no sodium, but these things aren't that, there's not that much sodium, right? I mean, they're not half normal. They're what, less than quarter or?
It says three, I just sent you all what we use in the Army. It's 3.5 grams of sodium chloride, 1.5 grams of potassium chloride, some citrate, and then 20 grams of glucose. In 1 liter, you mix it with 1 liter.
Three and a half of sodium chloride in a liter. So that's 17. A third normal.
In a liter.
But then you throw in some potassium, and that's going to bring it up probably closer to half normal, like Roger was saying. And then how much citrate? Just curious.
It says 2.9 grams of trisodium citrate.
Oh, so more sodium there too.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Joel, you
go on.
You probably have used oral salt tabs for volume repletion and just not thought about it, right? So when you do primary hyperaldosteronism testing, you're supposed to saline suppress people or salt load people. You can use salt tabs as your volume stimulus to try to shut off aldosterone secretion if you're doing oral salt loading for those folks. So it's nothing much fancier than that.
Usually what I do, Josh, is when I'm working up primary hyperaldos, I do a 24-hour urine for sodium. And I figure if their urine sodium is like 180, I don't need the salt load. That's a plenty of sodium that should be suppressing it. And all of my hypertensive patients have plenty of sodium in their diet. I've not come across any of them that have like only 60 millicolons of sodium. Oh, I wonder if this is a volume depleted patient. And that's why they have secondary hyperaldo.
So I'm still green enough that I do those things. And I'm mostly doing the IV saline challenge just because it's easier to manage the logistics of. But for resource poor settings, or if folks just don't want to come in and sit for 4 hours for a bunch of saline, you can do the oral salt tabs or just a bunch of potato chips.
But that 24-hour urine, you not only get it for sodium, you also get it for the aldo and some of the other metabolites of...
Yeah. But I think that this mechanism that JC was mentioning, that Rose mentions also about the sodium glucose reabsorption in small intestine, is really cool. I didn't know that was part of why ORS helps.
Well, that's why it helps specifically for cholera, because it's a secretory diarrhea. Mm. That's why it's important. And that's why it saved lives.
Wait, Anna, help me out. Walk me through that a little bit more. I'm missing that.
Because cholera is, I believe, because it's a secretory diarrhea.
It certainly is,
so they lose a lot of glucose sodium, that way. And so they lose more sodium through their stool because of the glucose that they lose. And so if you give them glucose, that slows down the exchange. I can voice over if you want me to be a little bit more exact about it, but. The reason why oral rehydration solution works is really, really cool. In the 1960s, Stanley Schultz and Ralph Zaleski demonstrated that the absorption of glucose from the intestine required the presence of sodium, and also that the presence of glucose in the small intestine, in this case of a rabbit, increased the potential of sodium across the mucosal surface. This was established as the effect of co-transport by using wheebane to inhibit the establishment of a sodium gradient by sodium-potassium ATPase on the basal surface of the epithelial cells. They also used a variety of sugar analogs like fructose, which is readily metabolized but not transported, and 3-O-methylglucose, which is not metabolized but is transported, to eliminate the possibility that this increase in sodium flux was just due to increased cellular energy production in the presence of glucose. Later studies identified that this cotransporter was in fact the sodium glucose cotransporter 1, or SGLT1. At a similar time period, it was discovered that the cholera enterotoxin caused a secretory diarrhea by the activation of adenyl cyclase, which resulted in increased cyclic AMP in intestinal epithelial cells. Not only did cyclic AMP stimulate active chloride secretion, it also inhibited the coupling of parallel ion exchangers NHe3 and the chloride bicarbonate exchanger, which normally produced electroneutral sodium chloride absorption. So simultaneously, we're increasing chloride secretion and inhibiting the reuptake of sodium chloride. But although the cyclic AMP inhibited that coupling, it did not inhibit the uptake of sodium via SGLT1. So the reason that the oral rehydration solution works is that the absorptive and secretory processes in the gut are separate and independent. And that's what we thought for the last 40 years. And it's estimated that that finding has saved over 50 million lives. But in 2011, a really cool study was published showing that the SGLT2 activity actually increases the activity of the apical or brush border sodium hydrogen exchanger. So not only does the SGLT2 override the effect of cholera or compete with the effect of cholera toxin, it might actually partially reverse the effect as well. And that might be one of the reasons why the oral rehydration solution works so well.
And so the ORS was really a cholera antidote.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering because there wasn't there like a saline shortage like a couple years ago? And so I was wondering like, oh, we should just bust out a bunch of ORS packets for the hospitalized patients. I mean, there's a lot of people who can still eat and drink in the hospital. 100%. So we give saline too.
Amy, have you tried the ORS?
I have not, but the soldiers say it's not bad. So it's probably okay. I mean, if they're drinking it for fun, it must not be that bad. So
I've tried this one, the one that I put in the link. It's not the best.
It's not the best.
I mean, it's not easy. It's salt tablets are disgusting, and anything, you know, gets really salty. It's pretty disgusting.
Yeah, I can buy a packet for you, Roger. You can do it on Twitter.
That's true. we'll do the ORS challenge. We've done every other challenge.
But the key is the ratio, I think, and harnessing, in this case, SGLT1 in the bowels. And, you know, the notion of having both of those so that you can use the power of that transporter to reabsorb, you know, sodium and glucose.
I was going to say, so he also mentions these rice-based solutions.
Yeah.
So my fellow told me they do this in India, actually. You just take dry rice and, you know, I don't know how you guys cook rice, but you're supposed to wash rice before you cook it. I hope you guys do that. And so, so not everyone does, but you're supposed to wash rice beforehand. And so you, that like rice water, that gelatinous rice water is drunk in India for like oral rehydration.
So you're saying when you wash the rice, you have this rice water and that's what becomes the rehydration solution? Is that what I'm getting?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
yep,
what is normally a waste product from the washing of the rice is now a therapeutic tool.
Exactly. Cool. Yeah.
That's so economical too.
Apparently in India, I mean, I've never done it before, but maybe our other listeners have done this
before. Is there sodium in it?
Well, you add that, right? So he says that the rice-based solution, so I think you start with this rice water and then you add in, he says it has more calories and amino acids, which promote the sodium reabsorption. So just like we have glucose sodium cotransporters, there's amino acids, and apparently that's a sodium cotransporter also. So that also assists in sodium reabsorption. Does that make sense? Sounds like something. I mean, it was reading this, it was like, I remember we were talking very early in this session. We were in the beginning of this podcast, we were talking about how the intestines are like a glomerulus or a nephron. And here's another example. We have the sodium glucose cotransporter. We have amino acid reabsorption also happening.
And not only that, we have aldosterone receptors, you know, so, cause I was trying to figure out what the normal stool sodium is. And it's actually pretty high, but I imagine if you get volume depleted, like it's, you know, 100, 150 millimoles a day or something. But I'm sure if you get volume depleted, that has to go way down, as long as you don't have your volume depletion isn't from a GI source. Because we've got aldosterone receptors in our sweat glands and our intestine. And what I tried to find out is what would your still sodium be if you're volume depleted? And I couldn't find it. But you'd think someone would have that. You'd think it would be minimal.
Well, it's a little hard to measure electrolytes in stool. And the question is, are you going to like make it liquid and then measure it? Or
that should be fairly protocolized, though, because they do that all the time to check for whether diarrhea is secretory or not.
Well, if it's liquid, you can. But in normal
stool. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But I think if it's normal stool, the amount of sodium is negligible because there's very little liquid volume to it.
I think you have to homogenize it, and we'll leave it at that.
That's not nice. We will remove that. We always edit these things to make us all seem really friendly and nice.
Thank you.
That's one of the primary roles of the editor.
Protecting ourselves
from ridicule.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
From getting canceled.
So it's a full-time job for you, Roger. Okay. We're done with oral, unless anybody else on oral therapy, they're IV therapy. And this was like, I feel like I've given this lecture a million times and I feel like I do it better than Rose. And so he was going through the different IV therapies. And the first one was dextrose solution. It's very kind of your standard medical student lecture. Giving dextrose solutions is essentially physiologically equivalent to water. The glucose is rapidly metabolized to CO2 and water, and that its indications are to treat hypernatremia and to cover insensible losses, full stop. Those are the only indications he's listed. I can't actually think of any others.
He's much more precise later when he starts to talk about like how he gives these extremely mildly hypotonic precise things to like, well, there'll be ongoing losses. I'm like, okay.
Don't get me started on how he starts to treat these patients. I'm with you there. That was like, okay.
I like he says it's physiologically equivalent to administering distilled water because basically the glucose gets all metabolized and you can't give distilled water because you get hemolysis. And, you know, I think a lot of times, medical students don't always realize that's why it's D5.
In our hyponatremia small group, we actually have a table where we ask the students to fill out like what happens to the different compartments, the three, when you give these, each one of these fluids. And we specifically put the dextrose solution there to make that point that the glucose is immediately metabolized. So it's effectively giving water, but sometimes that gets confusing. Like, I'm not sure that it's that they grasp it, to be honest.
I think that one thing, one little fun thing I like to quiz people on rounds is that, because I just recently learned it like 2 years ago, is that at least at my facilities, we put bicarbonate drips in D5 rather than in water, which you could put them in water, but it's just in case they forget to put the bicarb in. Somebody was like, why do they put dextrose in there? Like, what's the point of that? I mean, it's already isotonic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why, you don't need to.
No, I don't think
it's a safety step.
It's a safety step.
I don't think pharmacies have water.
Oh, no. In fact, our ICUs have sterile water. We have sterile water on the floor so that the nurses can compound stuff.
We can specifically order it in sterile water if you want to. Mm-hmm. But you have to like call the pharmacy and stuff. But it's
I can tell you as a resident and fellow and junior faculty, I was still able to order distilled water with bicarb added to it. And over the last 10 years or so, I can't anymore. I think it's a safety measure that has been implemented across the country.
And Burton Rose then goes on, talks about D20 and D50. And again, the only indications there were to give additional calories. 4 calories per gram glucose or dextrose is the caloric load.
And correction of hypoglycemia, right? Like that's the main reason we're using those kind of things?
That's the only
reason. Okay. If you're giving it for calories, like...
There are better things to get for calories.
Right. Not that many calories. And then remember, when you're doing the calculation yourself, it is not just glucose. It's not molecular weight of 180. It is glucose.H2O. And so it's a molecular weight 198. And so it's so D5, which you think would be have 50 grams of glucose, actually has somewhat less, 40 some odd grams of glucose, because it is not, it is glucose hydrate. And then any other thoughts on dextrose solutions? Okay, on to saline solutions. It says that most hypovolemic patients have a water and sodium deficit. He says that he brings in the news that isotonic saline has a sodium concentration of 154, which is similar to that of plasma. See page 000. My, you know, again, I get an incredible amount of joy from all the typos in the book, and here's another one.
I missed that one.
My favorite.
000.
Well, and then how about, did you get this one? The half isotonic saline, which is yes. The same paragraph,
yeah,
was equivalent to 550 cc's of isotonic saline and 500 of free water. That's a typo, right? It's not 550.
It's 500. Yeah, I caught that one. I missed the page.
Okay.
So one of my favorite things to do on rounds is to ask my students or residents or fellows, like, why? Wait a second. Why is normal saline 154 for the sodium? What's up with that? Is it just too hard to make 140? Or like, are we just bad at that? Or what's up with that? And then usually that keeps them busy for a little while I can answer a phone call or something. So
I like to expand on that. And so once I'm done with the explanation, I tell them that we all have pseudohyponatremia. Essentially, you know, if we measure 140, it's not really 140, but it's just what we recognize as pseudohyponatremia is just an exaggerated phenomena that's already occurring the way we measure it now. So I think that helps them too.
Melanie, how do you explain it?
So then I'll explain, I usually draw on the napkin or something, you know, that the plasma water has a sodium of 154, but that blood has a sodium of 140. And so then I'll talk about dilution, and then I'll do just what Roger does.
Right, the 10% of the volume is this in solid phase, right? So proteins and fats, lipids, representing about 10% of the volume, and 10% of 140 is 14. Add that to 140, and you get 154 normal saline. Yes.
Exactly. They like that one.
Okay.
I don't think we can – I'm sorry, I have to – I don't think we can talk about normal saline without – sending like a love letter to David Goldfarb for his piece in 2010 on the normal saline ceremony. I don't know if you guys have seen that. He wrote this cute perspective piece on how special, like how we don't appreciate normal saline, and that every medical student on matriculation should be given a bag to realize that they are now physicians and that this is something special. And he does a little bit about cholera and whatnot. I'll put it on the show notes. It's just a very special piece in, you know, in David's style. So
it is great. And I mean, it's like almost a daily process where you'll get a patient with profound acute kidney injury, and it'll be just put on something as banal as normal saline, and that creatinine just comes down so fast. And because it happens all the time and because it's low tech, we don't appreciate how amazing that is. I mean, I guess if you saw a child die in Uganda who couldn't get IV fluids, you might appreciate it more. But I do like to take a moment to appreciate those moments, because that is special. Then he goes on to 3% saline, and he points out that 3% saline is like giving normal saline plus an additional 359 additional mill equivalents of sodium on top of that.
It's very close to seawater.
Also, I saw in Europe they have like 1.4% and like 2%. Why do they have all these weird percentages in Europe? Like in the US, we have like 0.9, 2%, sometimes, and 3%.
They're better at decimals. Like, why does like doesn't one confuse them? Here we're like 1¾ saline.
I don't know. It's just interesting.
Yeah, when you read their studies, you're like 2.25%.
What would be the point of that? I mean, It is interesting because if you're going to give more, if you're going to, you know, the point of 2 and 3% is kind of to give sodium without water. 2% is like a cheater's 3% because you don't have a central line or whatever your hospital's rules are. And 2% doesn't even make a lot of sense. I mean, the idea behind 3% is sodium without the water part, because you're predominantly doing it for hyponatremia, but 1.5% is kind of silly.
I'm sorry, what's your knock on 2%? I don't even know why they would have. Sorry.
My knock is I just don't know. if I'm giving a hypertonic saline, I'm doing it, I want to give sodium without water. And so I'd rather just use 3%. And because, you know, now 2%, it's only twice as much sodium as a little over twice as much as normal saline. And then you are giving some volume. And, you know, what you're doing when you make these calculations for hyponatremia is you're basically adding sodium to the patient and you're pretty much ignoring the volume. You know, you can add the volume if you want, but it's so little that we tend to just make the calculations from the sodium and the 3% and add it using Edelman or whatever equation we want to do and find out, you know, what our osmolarity, our sodium goes up by. So 2% just seems like kind of a lame 3% to me.
But, I think what Roger was doing was identifying the practicalities of when that would be used while admitting the limitations physiologically.
But the idea of hypertonic saline, at least when I use it most, is like in correction of hyponatremia, and particularly say the folks with SIADH, you're trying to give lots of sodium loads such that no matter how much they concentrate their urine, they won't retain free water from the IV fluid that you give them. That's the problem with normal saline, right? You give someone a liter of normal saline, they have SIADH, they retain 500 cc's of free water and get rid of a half a liter of isotonic something. With 2%, you don't really make headway, whereas with 3%, you do.
3%, you can't desalinate 3%. That's why you can't drink seawater, because they're basically the same thing. So you can't extract electrolyte-free water from 3%. I did have a patient once that basically made 2% saline urine, so would have gotten nowhere with that. That was really, you know, quite unusual. I think the urine sodium was 300 or something, and whereas the 3% is like 514. I think 2% is 324 or something. And I have seen that. So yeah, you're right, Josh. It's twofold. It's one is, but one is to use a fluid that they can't desalinate. But really what we're trying to do is acutely give them a lot of sodium to pull water out of their brain. And you want to do that without giving them extra volume, because the calculation is much easier if you could just assume that I'm giving them, you know, 300 milliequivalents or 100 milliequivalents or whatever of sodium. I don't know. It just seems like 2% is kind of a cheesy 3%.
But it doesn't require ICU transfer some places, and that alone.
No, that's true. But yeah. our hospital always argues if you're going to give something other than saline, if they're bad enough that they need 2%, they should be in the unit for monitoring. And I think that's kind of a fair, you know, if someone's bad enough that your hyponatremia is really worried that you're going to give them any type of hypertonic saline, we put them in the unit just because they can't be monitored. You can't possibly get labs enough on the floor. So even then, that goes away at our hospital. Every other week we have to argue whether or not you can give 2% or 3% through a peripheral line. And it kind of depends on which pharmacist is on call that day. And even though there's good data that you can give 3% through a peripheral line, we push AMSA bicarb through a peripheral line, and that's, a thousand milliequivalents per liter.
Yeah, exactly. No, and we don't have to transfer to the ICU for this.
For any of it?
For 3%, or we don't have to transfer.
Yeah.
Just depends on the hospital.
Yeah, it varies from hospital to hospital. I think what I'm going to say is very obvious, but I think it's important to remind the listeners, this is a chapter on hypovolemic states. And I cannot think of a scenario that you would give hypertonic saline as a mainstay of restoring volume outside a context of hyponatremia being present, right? If somebody is massively volume depleted and there's no monotremic, you're just going to be wide open saline 1,000 mLs per hour and or emboluses. And we don't use hypertonic as a rescue volume, even though theoretically you would give more salt, sodium load, so it might be more effective. But, you know, typically we just bolus saline. So I just, you know, the hypertonic as Josh was saying, you know, it has a separate purpose of promoting water diuresis, which we'll discuss when we get to the hyponatremia chapter. But in this chapter, it seems
it's more useful to think of it as a medication.
Well, I think it has to be mentioned because he's describing the saline mm-hmm. solutions, but it's not really something that we use as a volume expander itself.
I think
Am I right?
I think you're spot on, JC. Yeah. I think it's a really good point mm-hmm. that this is not something you would be using unless you had no other choice. You'd be using saline, normal saline.
And I think just one thing along those lines, we talk about hypovolemic hypernatremia. And in those patients, if their blood pressure is low, you would give them normal saline. Like, don't worry about the sodium level, right? Like, their blood pressure is low. They're actually hypovolemic. They need some plasma volume. So you got to give them normal saline first.
Okay. Is the next fluid he goes in are just the dextrose and saline solutions, which essentially gives a little bit of calories, but are otherwise useless. And I think it was a pretty interesting kind of description. He's like, he doesn't seem really see a use for these things, just a few additional calories.
It's there for me to accidentally order when I'm trying to order D5, I think.
It's strange. Yeah.
Do you guys have the option of quarter normal in your?
Yes.
Yeah, we do.
And
the surgeons love it.
Peds use it, I think, a little bit. Who? Yeah. Letty, who uses it?
Surgeons. The surgeons.
Really? What are they surgery. Using it for?
Like maintenance, IV fluids. And it drives us nuts. All our patients get hyponatremic because they have, you know, non-baroreceptor mediated ADH activation, and then they all get hyponatremic.
So for our listeners, that was Anna that was...
I'm sorry, what?
I was going to edit that out.
No, there's
keep
a lot
that.
Of other people.
No, we should edit it out so our surgeons don't hear it.
The reason I asked was that when I was a resident, we had the option of half normal or D5 quarter. Quarter has to have some D5 in it because you'll get the same hemolysis issues, I believe. But I remember it was available, and I remember this is, you know, 40 years ago, like it was yesterday. An attending came up and he said, "Why do we have quarter normal saline? Is it real? Do you really need the difference between half normal and quarter normal?" And I obviously had no idea at that point to answer his question, but I think it was a pretty good question. I mean, maybe pediatrics need to tweak it enough, but I don't think adults need quarter normal versus
I don't think so either. I think what happens is that because these patients, especially some of them, like, you know, critically ill post-surgery, like CT surgery, they're getting so many fluids. I think what they're trying to avoid is the hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis. And so then they go, you know, they think of, like, you know, instead of just giving water or a physiologic solution, this was before. And the problem is that it's part of their, like, post-op order set. So patients come out, they order the order sets, and all these patients are on all these really hypotonic fluids, and they all get hyponatremic.
In defense of the surgeons and things like that, like, there are a lot of pressors and things like that that can only be in normal saline, right? And so if they're trying to balance electrolytes or whatever, maybe it makes sense to give them something hypotonic if there's some.
A number of years ago, there was an article in the pediatric literature looking at these quarter normal saline fluids and showing a real high rate of hyponatremia. And this has been a quality assurance move in pediatrics, moving away from quarter normal and third normal to normal saline and half normal saline, especially in the postoperative role. And they've seen a drop in the iatrogenic hyponatremia. So we're seeing less of those fluids that used to be kind of pediatric fluids being used.
Yeah, that seems like one of those things that if you did it in a study, it might not really cause, like, if you were really careful, it might not cause more hyponatremia. But what would happen is in real life, people would forget or miscalculate or whatever. Like, the more complicated you make it, the more room there is for error. So it'd be one of those things where I could see there being studies that didn't show that.
And the study was a retrospective analysis, just looking at the fluids people used in hyponatremia. So it was capturing all that. Okay, then he talks about alkalinizing solutions. He says that the bicarb is usually in, you know, 7.5% solution in 50 milliliter ampules and can be given as a bolus over 5 minutes.
So do you all remember when amps were 44 and an amp had 44 millimoles of bicarb? Am I the only one old enough?
I thought that was a typo.
No, they used to be 44. And then, you know, sometime between my medical school or my residency, they just said, it's silly. Let's make it 50. The math's a lot easier. But it used to be 44.
Plus it was 1950, so they figured, you know, make it.
Thanks.
Wow.
I'm not quite that old.
Yeah. Country time, remember.
I think the transition was, for me, from going from residency to fellowship, Roger. I started with 44, and then I was like, what? It's 50. Nobody told me this.
So you still did three, right? It was just slightly hypotonic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. You weren't like futzing with like 3.1 or something. No. Okay.
And the three we're talking about, right, is if you're making an isotonic bicarb drip for folks, you take a liter of D5, you pour off 150 mils, and you crack open 3 amps of bicarb into it to get something that approaches isotonic. I guess you can use water instead of D5, which is kind of mind-blowing to me. I feel like this is a thing I reach for a lot, and I feel like it's weird that it's not in here really at all as like an isotonic resuscitation fluid. But I feel like if folks are coming in with high ostomy output or like other non-GAP acidosis, this is like the thing I reach for first and does fix two problems at once, unlike quarter normal saline and water and D5.
What do you call it, Josh? We call it a bicarb drip, but
yeah, folks call it bicarb drip, or you just call it 150 mil equivalents bicarb and D5W. One of the places I trained had a 100 mil equivalent bicarb drip option, and that was just like prone to error. So I would always like specify the 150 mil equivalents of sodium bicarbonate in D5.
But so I get that they have this metabolic acidosis when they have this big diarrhea. But the outcomes for treating cholera with oral rehydration solution, which traditionally has no alkali in it, or maybe just a little dash of alkali, is really good. And I don't know I'm not sure that we gain a lot by resuscitating people, by adding that bicarb in the resuscitation fluid. I'd be happy to look at the data that shows that we do. I'd love for it to work because it makes sense that it does. But I'm just skeptical.
And it feels nice.
It feels really nice.
I'm sorry. It's a really good point. And I wonder if what they're dying of is hypovolemia, not metabolic acidosis. And that's really why, you know, it's really getting the volume back in them, which is much more important. And then they can perfuse and kidney work.
Bringing back memories of the cholera epidemic again, Joel, back in my days in Lima. So when the kids, or the adults actually, were presented with severe metabolic acidosis from the diarrheal losses, and the kidney function was relatively preserved, it was pretty clear that isotonic saline was enough. You didn't need to replete the bicarb. I think when we are seeing patients in the hospital with ongoing bicarbonate losses from the GI tract and non-anogenic metabolic acidosis and AKI, which further impairs the ability to handle acid, you know, at least theoretically it makes more sense to replete bicarb. But you're right. I mean, I don't think we have evidence showing that we, you know, save lives or anything like that. But it's a little bit different when there's AKI coexistent with the
other thing I would build on with JC's point is that most of the kids who come in with cholera don't have underlying lung disease like COPD and the other folks we see, right? So you can compensate for an acidosis pretty well if you have good lung function and you're 7, but it's a lot tougher if you're 70 and have advanced COPD.
I think that there is literature though in pediatrics that giving bicarb in DKA.
Yeah, in DKA we know that it's bad. Yeah.
In DKA, in anion gap acidosis, I'm hands off on that. Although I think there's a trial of anion gap non DKA acidosis that showed.
Yeah, there was a publication in the Lancet a couple of years ago that showed bicarb was beneficial, but it was the primary outcome was mortality. It did not meet that outcome. It did meet an outcome of decreased need for dialysis, which I felt was a little circular because one of the indications of dialysis is the acidosis.
Yeah. That's what it was.
It's generally read as a positive trial, but not in my house.
But I think what's important for the purposes of this chapter and what will stand the test of time is that no matter what is de rigueur for volume expansion, the point remains that you can volume expand just as well with a solution of equal parts salt and bicarbonate, however you want to mix them in whatever way. And that has the same effect on volume expansion.
Yeah.
Then that's the only point of it being in this chapter, right?
I think we had discussed at some point how a bolus of bicarb when a patient is in the middle of a cold gives a good sodium load just as a hypertonic, but we don't think about it, right?
It's twice as hypertonic as 3%, right? It's 1,000 sodiums per liter. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just wanted to add something that Anna briefly mentioned. It's sort of a practical, very simple point, but I think I find it useful. If you are in a volume resuscitating a patient with metabolic acidosis, but you're very interested in giving volume, the bicarb drip works great. You know, give a liter or 3 ounces isotonic. But sometimes you are more concerned about volume than the acidosis. And that's when what you mentioned, Anna, of the half normal with 1.5 amps of bicarb. You maintain an acetolic solution. Your concentration in bicarb is a little bit lower than that. And you can ramp up your rate go from 100 to 200 mils per hour without worrying of iatrogenic alkalosis. So I think it's very simple, but sometimes it's nice to have both options.
Yeah. I think there's 1,000 clinical scenarios you could argue that it's maybe not a great idea to do it.
Burton Rose gave it two sentences and we've been going on for 5 minutes. Okay, we're going to move along. Polyionic solutions, which I had never heard this term before. I don't remember hearing this term before. And this is his catch-all for what we now call balanced solutions, the more physiologic Hartman solutions, lactated ringers. He has ringers. He separates out lactated ringers from ringer solution. And boy, has there been a lot of data on this since this was published in 2000. He is quite the poo-pooer of balanced solutions. And there's been 1 million randomized controlled trials, I think is the last count on this question.
Should we even go down this?
I don't really want to go down it. I feel like I've talked about it a lot, but let's take a moment to go through this. So as of 2000, when this book is written, or 1999, Burton Rose solidly comes down on the side of normal saline is as good as balanced solutions, and we don't need to worry about balanced solutions. Subsequent to this, especially in the ER literature, lots of work showing that the high sodium content causes a retention of fluids, decreased urine output compared to less high concentrations of sodium, which is what you typically see in these polyionic solutions, and then the high chloride concentration resulting in a non-anion gap, metabolic acidosis, and possible problems with that. This resulted in a number of trials of varying quality that have had varying outcomes. From probably the most famous one was the Smart Lee and Salt Ted trials that came out of Vanderbilt, large single center trials. Salt Ted was done in the ER with a primary outcome of length of stay. It was their primary outcome was negative, but a secondary outcome showed a reduction of something called major adverse kidney events, MAKE, a composite outcome that I had not been familiar with before, which was like, dialysis death and elevated creatinine at 30 days, I think is what MAKE was. And they did find a 1% increase in that outcome. And then the Smart Lee was the same question of balanced solutions versus normal saline. It's not specifically lactated ringers versus normal saline in the ICUs. And there the primary outcome was MAKE, and there the outcome was significantly different. They met their outcome. And again, about a 1% reduction with MAKE with the lactated ringers. And then subsequently there was BASICS. And what was the other one that was negative? Voice of God, the names of the negative balanced solutions versus normal saline trials.
So I promised a rundown of the RCTs of balanced versus normal saline. We talked about the SALTID and SMART trial, both of these done at Vanderbilt, both of these very large pragmatic trials. SALTID had 13,000 patients, SMART had 15,000 patients. both of them were significant with a small effect size with a number needed to treat of 100. Prior to that, there was the split trial published in 2015 in JAMA, 2,200 patients, no difference in AKI. Then in 2021, the BASICS trial, this was published in JAMA, 11,000 patients, no difference of death within 90 days. And then the PLUS trial, 2022, New England Journal of Medicine, 5,000 ICU patients, death within 90 days was not different. And then most recently was BEST Fluids. This is balanced crystalloids versus normal saline in patients after kidney transplant, and a pretty significant reduction in delayed graft function with balanced solutions with a relative risk of 0.74. There were about 400 patients in each group in that study. That's kind of where we are today. Anybody have any editorial comments on this?
Where does it land for you, Joel? I mean, it was all there. They were a pariah, and then they're not a pariah. And what do you think?
If I'm using lots of volume, I use balanced solutions because I just don't want to have to deal with the metabolic acidosis. It just seems like I'm creating a problem that I'm going to feel obligated to fix down the road. Right. Because I actually believe in the metabolic acidosis and CKD theory. I don't like leaving my CKD patients with metabolic acidosis. So I do use balanced solutions, but I used to be pretty dogmatic about it, and I am less so now.
I mean, it's the problem. You get these studies are very well designed. They have tons of patients, and they come up with different conclusions, and it leaves you kind of, what do you do? You know, when do you stop doing them? The one thing I thought that was interesting that I've always found in these is that, especially the Vanderbilt study, which I remember the most because it was the first big one that came out, was it was highly statistically significant because they had huge numbers of patients.
I think it was 14,000.
Yeah. But yeah, this difference in mortality was, or whatever their endpoint was, I don't remember, was extremely small, but it was highly statistically significant because they had 14,000 patients. So statistical significance does not always mean clinical relevance. And, you know, you could have had 100 patients and 50, you know, or 20 patients and 10 died, but that may not be powered. On they could all die on one therapy and all live, but it may not be powered to actually prove something when it's actually a more clinically relevant study. So I just always thought, yes, there may be a difference. I just don't know how clinically relevant a 0.1% in survival is. And I think it's an important point. It was very well powered.
Roger?
Oh, I'd be happy to use, I have no problem using balanced solutions. I just don't think it's the end all. I'm happy to. It makes more, you know, it's they're basic. The argument used to be it was a lot more expensive. Now they're not even any more expensive. Or if they are, it's minimal compared to the cost of everything else in the hospital. So I have no problem. I just, you know, there are people in the ICU that believe that these things just absolutely, you know, if you're giving saline, we're killing people with chloride. That's what bothers me, is chloride toxicity. They're not even understanding, you know, what the potential issue is. Might have to be dilution acidosis, that somehow chloride is bad, even though we have so much, you know, we're swimming in chloride, literally and figuratively. It's not cyanide.
Amy, what do you like?
I like both. I do tend to use more balanced solutions now, but and it's mostly just like you said, Joel, I just don't want to have to deal with the electrolyte abnormalities later. And I don't want to have to talk to pharmacy about compounding half normal with 1.5 bicarb and then put a little KCL in there, you know? And so that takes forever to come up from the pharmacy. And so sometimes if I think I want to give a lot of electrolytes or whatever, or if they have like a diarrhea, then I'll just give it. Cause I'll tell you, as a hospitalist, like, it's nice to just have all the numbers look better and the patients better, and then they go home. Like, you don't have to keep them an extra day because they still have this acidosis. Like, I mean, that's a real reason why people stay, just because their labs still look a little wonky.
Anybody on team saline?
I am.
Tell us more, Anna.
I'm on team saline because it's simple. And I try really hard to focus, instead of thinking really hard about LR versus saline, I try really hard to try to focus on giving the least amount of fluid for the least amount of time to only accomplish my goal.
Yeah.
And then everything else shakes out in the wash. So I try really hard to instead shift my focus from which thing should we use to When should we stop? Have we accomplished our goals? Because I would be willing to bet that a lot of the differences in those labs is because you haven't actually volume resuscitated someone or you've over-resuscitated someone. And so I try to shift my energy to getting them kind of out normal into their life again and eating regular food and whatever. And that's kind of what I choose to focus my energy on. And people are like, do you like LR? I'm like, I don't care. Whatever you want to use doesn't matter to me. But in an ideal world, I like saline because it's simple.
I think that's the key. And that's super hard to do because, you know, the gut reaction always is like, you know, even if the blood pressure, the MAP dips a little bit, it's like a liter and eventually the liters just accumulate. And I do think that that's what's harmful. I guess one thing that I would say about these other fluids, and I don't know, I remember asking you all a few months back about this, if you've ever seen a lactic acidosis from LR in somebody who has underlying liver disease. And I know there's case reports, right, of the lactate actually going up. And so...
Well, the lactate will go up, but you're not giving lactic acid, you're giving sodium lactate. So you might have the lactate might go up, but it should not be consuming bicarb. So it's really a...
Right. Yeah. But I think that's another case of the numbers just look worse. Yeah. Right? Like it, and so even though like you're not actually like causing any harm, like people don't, like people want like everything to look better on paper. But it looks nice in the
But then that led to the patient getting scanned and looking for intra-abdominal sepsis now because the lactate was like 2.9, you know, something around like that. And then after like two bags of LR, the lactate was 11. And it was like mass panic, you know? So meanwhile, the patient was looking better.
Yeah. Yeah. But he does mention that in the book a little bit, right? He says, try not to give it if you have a lactic acidosis.
Yeah, but it makes sense. I think, Roger, you have done elegant tutorials on this on Twitter, and probably you should share that right now. But I think, Amy, what Bert Rose was trying to point out here is that when you give lactate ringer, you're hoping that a lactate is going to be converted to bicarbonate. So you are less successful providing bicarb if you're not converting it because of the liver disease. It's not like you are giving acid at all or you're worsening the alkalosis. You are less successful correcting the acidosis, but not because you are less effective providing a bicarb source.
But if you were giving saline, there would be no bicarb source, right? That's the other thing. So
I remember there was this kid in the, well, not kid, he was a resident when I was a fellow in the ER. He was started someone, instead of on a bicarb drip, he started him on an acetate drip. And I was like, well, you can. I mean, he can convert that acetate to bicarb, but why? Like, just put him on a bicarb drip. It's not like it's, anyway, but yeah, to your point, JC.
Well, just when we had those sodium bicarbonate shortage, that would have been a strategy.
Sure.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
You know, Melody brought up the 154 normal saline being, you know, actually what our blood sodium water would be. Lactated ringers is in the 130s, yep. I think. So it's actually a little bit, you know, it's not quite, you're not going to get as much bang for your buck volume-wise. It's a little bit hypotonic. I don't know why they do that, because maybe it's everything else they add and they want the osmolality to look better or something. I don't know, but it's quite a bit lower.
I think it is 130. And then, so then by the same analogy, it's actually, you know, like 120, really.
Exactly.
And I think that's the idea of like giving a little of everything, that you're giving a little water, a little potassium, you know, a little acetate.
I remember, you know, when I first heard about lactated ringers, I was a medical student, and it was the surgeon's fluid, because they're thinking of it as like blood. You know, if you're just giving fluid and no calcium, then you can't, your blood won't coagulate. You know, you need calcium for blood coagulation, and you need bicarb and a little bit of potassium. And so it was a perfect resuscitative fluid for someone who is bleeding out. You know, I didn't know there was a ringer solution, not a lactated ringer solution, until I read this. I thought that it was always just lactated ringers.
And there's Plasmolite too. I think Plasmolite is newer, yeah. But that's
and Normasol. All those, yeah.
What's the base in Normasol?
Yeah, what's in Normasol?
Is it also acetate?
No, I do not.
Probably acetate.
sodium chloride, sodium acetate.
Yeah, it's acetate, yeah.
Yeah, he's got the all the IV fluids, or some of the IV fluids in table 14.6.
Ringers. How come we don't use ringers anymore? Why do we just use lactate ringers?
Try to call it next time. You don't want to get, if you've got somebody with liver failure, be like, I'm going to use ringers, and people will take you to task on it and be like, no, I didn't say lactate ring.
Well, take a look at the chloride concentration in ringers. It's 156. Mm. So if the whole point of this lactated ringers was to get the chloride down, you're not accomplishing that with your ringer solution. You really need the ringers lactate to get that low chloride.
Yeah.
Look at the one that's interesting is the potassium chloride in grams per 100 ml. It's like off the scale of any of these, right? 14 grams per 100 ml.
That's a K rider.
Yeah, that's the K rider. Yeah, so that was the next fluid, and I never thought of it as a fluid. Like it's giving potassium, yeah. Right? And so he has some interesting points. He says that it's 2 milliequivalents per ml of potassium. So it's really, really concentrated, right? Your potassium concentration is 2,000 per liter, right? Isn't that what that comes out to? That's bananas.
That would all go intracellular.
Specifically. I should wear a hat.
I would never have listed that. Like, name all the IV solutions you can think of. I don't think I'd ever would have said potassium chloride.
You know, in fact, think about it. If you give hypertonic potassium chloride, that's going to go in the cells, and that means the cells are going to be then hypertonic. And to have osmotic equilibrium, you're going to have to pull water from the extracellular space into the cellular space. So if anything, it might actually make your intravascular volume a little less.
You heard it here. Roger Rodby is recommending.
He said do not give it as a
high concentrations of sodium chloride.
Against potassium chloride. As a resuscitation fluid, seems like wisdom.
Thanks, Anna. I totally deserve that.
No, it is interesting, though.
Okay. It says, don't give it as a bolus. It could cause fatal hyperkalemia. So about potassium chloride.
There you go.
Okay. Plasma volume expanders, albumin,
That's called?
That's Hetastarch,
right? Yeah.
Hetastarch. These are all theoretically restricted to the vascular space. And then he says that 25% albumin can pull fluid into the vascular space. And then this is totally it's just like basic stuff, but I've never thought about it. He says that 25% albumin is like an albumin concentration of 25.
That's a lot.
I was like, oh yeah, that's exactly what it is. I just never thought of it that way. I was like, wow, that is useful to think about. I will teach it that way in the future, right? You know, and so
it's disappointing it doesn't work that way. Like you can't just that Gaston eating his 25 eggs or like Rocky eating his 25 eggs, you know, you don't just absorb that and then get really hypertensive. No, it doesn't work that way.
It does not work that way.
Gaston and Rocky. That's what we've gotten to.
I'm bringing in pop culture references, Roger. Very old pop culture.
Now, one interesting thing about albumin is that sodium concentration in a bottle of albumin is 145 milliequivalents in a 25% bottle. So if you were to, it is.
I thought it was 130.
I think it's 145. I mean, we can double check, but it's very close to, isotonic level. So it's important because we're not giving albumin with water. So I mean, in the big scheme, it's not a big deal. But if you're given 25 grams of albumin every 6 hours, for instance, to give the 100 gram dose, that's going to be 400 mLs of volume that is actually containing sodium. It's not, I mean, if you do it in one day, it's probably not a lot. But if you do that for 3-4 days, you are providing a sodium. So sometimes we try to give albumin in a patient that we want to expand volume, but we don't want to give sodium. Well, we are. We are giving sodium as well.
I think it's even more important. I did not know that there was sodium in there. So that's very interesting. And it's not a little bit. I mean, if it's 140 milliequivalents, that's like the equivalent of a liter of saline,
Yeah, but it's not. No, but think about the size of the package. It's not that much volume.
It's right. Not 140
liter.
That's the concentration.
Oh, it's the concentration, not the total amount.
Correct.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah, but we used to use that as a trick. Like if we wanted the patient to get a little saline because for whatever reason we thought the patient needed volume and they and the team didn't want to, we're like, oh, give some albumin.
The secret move. That's pretty good.
But I do think we should be careful. I am totally a proponent of albumin. I think I probably bankrupt the medical center here because I love ordering albumin because I do think that the way that albumin has been studied, if we're always looking for a mortality benefit, which is so hard to prove, right? But if we look at other other outcomes, I do think that albumin is a great resuscitative fluid. One thing that I have seen, though, is and that we do have to be careful is that, you know, when you're giving this oncotic load, the interstitial fluid, again, the different spaces, that will move as well. And I have seen cases of acute pulmonary edema after even a 250cc bolus of albumin. So I do think that we, you know, that is just some another consideration to think about when giving albumin, that there is, because of the change in oncotic pressure, there will be movement of fluid and you can.
Well, and that's my beef with albumin is that it's like the safe thing to give in HR, like in cirrhotic patients. It's not that I don't think it's useful. It's that people give it like it's candy because they act like it's just never, ever going to go anywhere. Yeah.
They overuse it. Yeah. They think it's like magic.
When he talks about a meta-analysis that was done that showed an increased mortality with albumin. I remember when that Cochrane review came out, I know our residency program and our hospital freaked out and they pulled albumin from the formulary. There may have been some exceptions, but generally what was available to us all of a sudden became not available to us. And that launched what was called the SAFE study, which is one of the largest IV fluid studies that was done, and it was normal saline versus albumin. And Roger was talking about how these great studies have been done between normal saline and lactate ringers. To me, that's like Coke versus Pepsi. And this is like Coke versus milk, right? And we were able to find a difference between Coke and Pepsi, even though it was small. And when we did the SAFE study, those lines completely overlapped, and there was no difference at all in the outcome. And I think what it really did was say, hey, those mortality concerns about albumin, that it was dangerous, really don't exist. This is an infusion that is safe, but all the theoretical advantages for albumin, none of them manifested there at all. And it's bizarre that they're the same. And one of the other interesting things is that if we do the math from the kind of the way Burton Rose has kind of talked about, well, we talked about how much you give a liter of saline and 250 cc's will remain in the intravascular compartment. And if you give a liter of albumin, all of it remains in the intravascular compartment. And so you would expect that for these patients that were being dosed on these things, that you'd use 1/4 as much volume of albumin. And it didn't turn out that way at all. It was just a 40% less. And so it was like one of those kind of real world studies to show that, hey, this albumin really leaks out quite fast and we don't get the big advantage that we get when we just kind of
do that. No, I was just going to ask JC. So like, what do you think of albumin in cirrhotics? Like, obviously you've studied this a lot. Like I am the opposite of Letty. I'm kind of an albumin hater only in special scenarios. I don't really feel like it adds anything more than other solutions. I'm just curious what you think.
Well, again, I have, use albumin, I have read. I wouldn't take credit that I have researched it myself, Amy, but it's probably the only condition.
Let the podcast listeners know that he's wearing a t-shirt that says like a Superman. It's amazing.
Yeah.
The way that
cirrhosis is the only condition where I intentionally make recommendations to give insulin. Outside of cirrhosis, I never do, not even in a nephrotic patients or anything, which is a different discussion. But so what evidence do we have in cirrhosis? There's ancient evidence, old studies in the 70s, where individuals were received albumin or saline, and they looked at hemodynamic changes. Typically, they would look at changes in plasma renin activity, and they will show that in a cirrhotic, albumin is more effective blunting your plasma renin activity in a short period of time compared to saline. Those were the early studies that defined the physiological albumin is more effective. And there have been actually a couple of very recent studies by hepatologists in India. One study, I think it's called the FRISC study, randomized controlled trial. He compared 5% albumin versus saline. The FRISC, correct, F-R-I-S-C, not K. The endpoint was improvement of MAP at the 3-hour mark. And they showed that giving 5% albumin was more effective, correct, getting the patients out of the hypovolemic shock in a 3-hour period compared to saline. And then more recently, the same investigators went on to use 20% albumin, not 25, 20% is probably what they have available in India, compared to plasma light. And they also showed that it was more effective. However, in this 20% albumin study, they observed a higher rate of pulmonary complications that led to 20% discontinuation. So we're seeing more and more of this evidence now.
And we saw the pulmonary complications also in the recent hepatorenal syndrome studies of albumin, where they had increased pulmonary edema, just like Letty was talking about.
Yeah, not only in the confirmed trial, Joel, but also in this other ATTIRE trial, that it was a trial designed to just fix the albumin up to normal or not. And they did. Nobody got better, and they ended up having also an increased incidence of pulmonary complications. So we're learning more and more that, yes, it is probably more effective as a volume expander in a short-term period, but you got to be careful with the potential complications if you overdo it.
Yeah, it was interesting. The prior art on the Affirm, was the ATTIRE trial, the Affirm trial, is really interesting. That it's these Italian studies where they were just having people coming in for regular albumin infusions if they had cirrhosis, and they had really remarkably good outcomes. But it was another one of those situations. Only they tried to repeat that.
I was just going to say one thing about the sodium load of albumin. So I have actually seen a couple of hepatologists here prefer to use albumin to treat hyponatremia. I don't know if they know exactly why, or if they know that there's sodium in albumin or not, but I really don't know, like, or if they're just like, oh, albumin will fix this. But I always tell the fellows, like, there's sodium in albumin, so maybe that's what's helping them.
The only thing I've ever heard about head of starch is, like, don't even mention it. Because the thing about albumin is, like, you're saying, oh, yeah, it stays inside your blood vessel. And I mean, obviously nothing physiologic stays in your blood vessel, because otherwise you'd get an infusion of albumin and you'd never have to eat salt ever again, right? Like, but just stay there forever. But head of starch is an interesting concept, like, because it's something that should not be, like, do people actually use this, or does anybody remember this being used? No, not really.
Well, I don't know if in, like, back in quote unquote the olden days, if they used it, but before us, Anna. But in the military, actually, the medics carry head of starch because they want to use it in trauma situations. And so, like, this risk of like clotting and things like that is actually, like, a good thing, right? Because they're dealing with blown limbs and trauma and stuff like that. And they're only supposed to give up to a liter. And then after that, they're supposed to give normal saline. But by that time, hopefully the helicopter comes and can medevac the patient. So, and I know the military purchases a lot of head of starch for that reason.
Okay. The last type of fluid is blood, and we're all familiar with blood. So I don't know. I'm moving along. Which fluid to use? He says, look at the patient's osmolality and give hypotonic fluids to people with high osmolality. That seemed to be intelligent. And then he says, make sure you match their electrolyte abnormalities. And there is an entirely absurd example in case history 14-3, in which he has a patient with severe diarrhea, has a sodium of 142, a potassium of 3.7, a bicarb of 8, and a pH of 7.22 and a urine sodium of 4. And his solution for this is to give half normal saline and then add 77 milliequivalents of potassium to that to make it isotonic. And then I think he threw in a splash.
This feels like a solution that the patient will die while you're making from hypovolemic shock, because it's going to take you so long to do the math and mix the things. at some point, like,
I agree.
LR is really nice because you can just get the bag and give it to the person if they need it. Same for saline, but I don't know. Maybe I'm on the other end of the spectrum from Anna with the LR or saline debate, where there's either a suggestion of benefit or a suggestion of just as good, but either way, the error bars are in that direction. So I feel like I'm not doing harm by reaching for that most of the time, but I feel like waiting to mix this thing up is definitely doing.
I definitely also thought in this scenario, the idea of correcting for perceived potential future ongoing insensible losses, like, you don't think this lady's ever going to get better and drink again? I don't know. I just was like, this is really.
The only thing I remembered about Hedda Starch is reading this case as somebody shared with me once where, you know, remember we glomerulus filters because the hydrostatic pressure inside the glomerular capillary, it beats the oncotic pressure that pulls fluid back into the capillary, right? So if you give Hedda Starch and theoretically ramp up your oncotic pressure to the point that that overcomes the hydrostatic pressure, you're going to be filtering in the opposite direction and drop your GFR. So they reported these cases. I don't recall if they actually had any type of measurements of renal blood flow or anything like that, but I thought that just the concept was pretty cool. Have you guys heard about that?
No, that is interesting, though.
No? Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to go back and
therapeutic see, decrease in we give all of our hemorrhaging patients NSAIDs so that they don't accidentally make any urine and, you know, worsen things. That's interesting.
And then he talks about blood and
yes, I went trauma. Down a rabbit hole. Does anybody else have anything to say about this? Because I was very interested in this and I got lost because this seemed like one of those things because, you know, now in 2022, it's all like if you're bleeding, give blood. If you're bleeding, give blood. If you're bleeding, give blood. The trauma people, you know, that's the thing. But I was very interested in this because I kind of forgot about this, like, I don't really pay much attention to that. I just kind of peripherally aware of it. But the idea of, one, I mean, obviously diluting out your clotting factors, but two, the idea that bringing a blood pressure in a hemorrhaging patient back to normal causes, like, the hypotension basically decreases how quickly they're bleeding, which I understand, like, stop squeezing the bag if there's a hole in it. But I thought that was fascinating that this was ever a thought. So I was reading through the guidelines of, like, is this still what we think? Because this was 20 years ago, and it seems like one of those things that has probably been tested up and down the wazoo. And it turns out it has, because the concept was, you know, keep their MAPs low because you might be causing end organ damage, but you'll be slowing the bleeding, and that gets them to the OR, right? Which makes kind of sense in a way. So I was looking at the European guidelines of trauma resuscitation or something, and the fourth edition was in 2010. And at that point, they were still recommending a MAP of 65, and that was their reasoning, was only resuscitate them to a MAP of 65. And then when I read the fifth guidelines, which I think were in 2019, they had updated that, but there was a meta-analysis saying that in most cases it was kind of plus or minus and there wasn't convincing evidence either way. So they just kind of left it at, like, you know, use your clinical judgment. If you think they're still bleeding, maybe tolerate a little bit of lower blood pressure. The exceptions being, of course, spinal or cerebral hypoperfusion because of the irreversible end organ damage there. But I thought that was really interesting. It's never something I mean, I'm never a person sitting down there in the ER saying, like, hey, maybe don't give this person more blood if they're in the their systolics were in the 80s or 90s in some of these trials, you know, saying, hey, you know, now that they're not in the 60s, that's good enough, and stop resuscitating them because we'll get them to the OR and stop the bleeding, and any more that you give if they have penetrating trauma is just going to come out all the faster.
This was a lesson to me. I didn't know anything about this. It was non-intuitive. It came as a shock to me. No pun intended.
I mean, the clotting factor thing I was aware of, and that's a big part of why people would just bang this drum, which makes sense. But even all things held equal, you know, if you're just using crystalloids, like, stop resuscitating them when they get to, I mean, it's not like if I were in this scenario, I don't think I'd be trying to resuscitate people to 150 systolic, but I don't think I would say, hey, 80s is good enough.
The next section is on the volume of fluid to give to correct the deficit. And he throws in a couple of equations to talk about where if you have an altered sodium, that allows you to calculate a volume deficit or a sodium deficit. something that I don't typically use. But that's the idea that if your sodium is low, you calculate a sodium deficit, and then you can figure out how much saline to give. And if your sodium is high, you can calculate a water deficit, and it'll figure out how much D5 to give. And then there was even, he has a formula for calculating volume deficit based on hemoconcentration, and he provides that. And he and the one for hemoconcentration is interesting because he says that if you don't have, if you have isotonic losses, you won't change the serum sodium, and that will prevent you from using these formulas for calculating volume. And so I thought that was good. Anybody else have thoughts on the volume? He says serial exams are important.
Yeah, I don't like the calculating somebody's volume based on their serum sodium. That's like, that's the opposite of what we teach about, right? You know, it's, we say the you can have any volume status with any serum sodium, and those, you should think of those independently. And he's kind of pulling us backwards in there. I don't like that at all. I think you need to, you give volume clinically, and you can, what fluid you give may have a, there may be a relationship with the serum sodium, but especially with hypernatremia, but, you know, I don't like to put those two together. And he does a lot of micromanaging. I mean, you know, like you're actually going to figure out how, the sodium deficit in somebody by using this equation and you knowing how much sodium they're behind, or the one before where he's making up this crazy fluid. I just don't think that's very practical. Yeah. The, you know, whether it's the timing that, you know, Josh brought up or not, it just isn't very practical. It's not what people do.
No, I agree.
Unnecessary.
Same thing with the crit, you know. Yeah. He's got calculations based on the hematocrit. I don't think anybody does.
And I think also, I mean, if you're going to do this at one point in time, that's one thing, but it's not just, it's every time then their labs change, then you have to redo it. And these are all opportunities for error. I feel like I'm on a QI kick tonight, but really, I mean, you know, it's not like their labs are going to stay the same and you're not going to draw them for days. It's just kind of nutty.
Thing. Yeah, the hematocrit equation, do folks ever use that crit line feature on some of the dialysis machines? Is that something folks are familiar with? This is kind of like the same idea. I think that you can, like, by looking at where someone's hematocrit starts and where it ends, or where it's going over the course of the dialysis treatment, make an estimate over how much volume you've gotten off or how much closer to euvolemia they are. It's like a cool math modeling idea that kind of makes sense. But again, like I think everyone said, like, clinical judgment.
That works. That works because you know you've got a crit to start with and you're changing it in real time. But what he's talking about is just taking a person out of the clear blue with a hematocrit and you don't know where they were before. So
right. So what's nice about that dialysis feature is you know you're starting hematocrit and you can continue to recalculate it throughout the course of the dialysis or whatever other thing you're doing. So that makes it actually almost useful.
The idea behind it, just for the listeners, is if the crit's going up too much, you're pulling off fluid faster than you can refill, and you'll probably need to cut back on your ultrafiltration rate
of a volume replacement. I thought this was I liked his thoughts on this. Is a way I hadn't thought about it. He says the goal is not to just give fluid, but to induce a positive fluid balance. And he suggests to target 50 to 100 milliliters an hour over what is coming out of the body, which is a great way to think when we think about, oh, how much fluid can they tolerate? No one thinks about their ongoing constant losses. And so he says, well, look at their urine output, look at their insensible losses, and consider that to be 30 to 50 cc's an hour. Look at that diarrhea. All of that can be deducted from your fluid when you think about how much patients can tolerate. And I thought that was a good point, not one that is commonly thought
I think
about.
Giving fluids at 100 an hour takes 10 hours to get a liter in. That's like you can pee and poop a lot and vomit a lot in 10 hours.
Do they still teach in medical school like how to calculate a maintenance fluid rate? Like I feel like, oh, they don't do that.
You use a Holliday-Seeger method?
Well, I don't. I mean, there's like the 4-2-1 rule and like the 150.
That's
okay, yeah, 150-20. Yeah, because I've asked a couple of residents about this and med students, and they just look at me like I'm crazy. So, just
I
was curious.
I don't know. Wouldn't you guys be happy if maintenance fluids just died for most people? Like, if we could just bolus people if they need them. I don't know. I feel like maintenance fluids get us into so much trouble because they start and never go away, and I never end up recommending them, and I'm always trying to turn them off. So if people forget how to calculate that, that would be just fine with me.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, you could just like cap it, like do 2 liters at such and such
rate. Right. But
anyway.
Okay. So sometimes we assess a patient, we determine, okay, this patient appears voluntary-depleted. Let's give it a trial of fluids. And then we want to reassess the next morning. And if we are running in the mid-afternoon consult, we provide recommendations, and then we have to communicate the recommendations to the primary team. The primary team has to place the order. The order has to be taken by the nurse. Pharmacy sim ships the back to the floor. We're looking at 11 o'clock midnight when the backup sending arrives to the floor, and at 4 a.m. we get labs rechecked. So you come back the next morning to round and assess if your intervention worked, and you cannot assess if your intervention worked. So I am very aggressive with my team to make sure that when we come back tomorrow, we're going to have an answer, at least something close to an answer. So at that point, you know, this is where giving a bolus of fluid, a saline, is very helpful, because you guarantee half a liter at least of your liter and a half or liter we want to give. So it's just a practical point to implement. Mm.
Team bolus.
Okay, very good. He then goes on to hypovolemic shock. It's most often due to bleeding or third space sequestration. And this, he has this really interesting, this is figure 14.3 where they bleed out the dogs and they drop their, they bleed them enough to drop their blood pressure down below 50. I think that's systolic. No, mean arterial pressure down to 35 to 40 millimeters. And if they do it for just 2 hours and then they restore their blood pressure, the dog lives. And then if they do it for 4 hours and then they restore their blood pressure, they bring the blood pressure back up to 150, the dog can't sustain that blood pressure and is dead by 10 hours. And the point of this is that if you have this prolonged hypotension or volume depletion from bleeding, this is the definition of shock. It's this progress. It leads to increased sympathetic nervous system, increased angiotensin II. Initially, this process will maintain blood pressure, cerebral and coronary circulation, but you can get lactic acidosis. You can get translocation in the intestines. The irreversible shock is associated with the pooling of blood in the capillaries, get vasomotor paralysis, hyperpolarization of vascular smooth muscle as depleted ATP allows potassium flowing out from K channels, opening and calcium flowing out too, leading to vasodilation and then plugging of capillaries by neutrophils, cerebral ischemia, and increased nitric oxide generation. So kind of he goes through a number of different mechanisms for this, but this kind of irreversible shock after prolonged hypotension was
he's describing surge, right? I mean, this, well, I guess that's outdated terminology now.
What would be the would be the current terminology for this, the terminology for
people
the, what
aren't
we, what
saying
he described
SIRS
here
anymore, right? It's just shock. And
I don't know, is SIRS not a thing anymore? They don't call it SIRS anymore?
All the residents call it SIRS still.
I didn't know that.
I was gonna say, I think this is, I had a attending tell me, I think this is kind of like, he called it the law of Laplace, unless I'm remembering it wrong, where basically all shock, prolonged shock, ends up becoming distributive shock. And I'm wondering if that's kind of what he's describing here. So
yeah, I'll do a voice of God on this, but sepsis 3 is what it's called now. The Society of Critical Care Medicine abandoned the phrase SIRS in 2016.
So. They abandoned it in 2016?
Yeah. I feel really old.
Get used to it. You're only getting older.
I remember like learning this and then saying like there were however many SIRS criteria, and I was poo-pooed on my CCM round. So
yeah, we used to call them SIRS-y. Like your patient is like pre-sepsis-y, they're SIRS-y. And now like I guess you say they're, I don't know, S3 or something.
SIRS 3 apparently now. Yeah, anyway, I'll do a voice of God over this
sepsis
if you want
3.
To, but I don't know if that's necessary. But yeah, we don't, just FYI guys, we don't say SIRS anymore.
I love your voice of God.
So I was remembering this right. The term SIRS has been thrown out, and that happened in 2016. What happened was in 1991, there was a consensus conference that developed this initial definition based on the idea that sepsis was the result of a host's systemic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS, and this happened in the setting of infection, and that what was really pathologic was not the infection itself, but the systemic inflammatory response. And so the SIRS criteria you could meet by having two or more of the following criteria. So temperature above 38 or below 36, heart rate over 90, respiratory rate over 20, or PaCO2 less than 32, or having a white blood cell count that was greater than 12,000 with some differential limits as well. And so the European Society of Intensive Critical Care Medicine and the Society of Critical Care Medicine had a third international consensus task force in 2016, and they examined these definitions. And one of the things they found that was problematic was that the SIRS criteria don't necessarily indicate a dysregulated or life-threatening host response. I remember hearing when I was training that you could climb up the stairs and meet SIRS criteria. And in fact, that was true. When they looked at big cohorts of patients, many people who did have SIRS criteria didn't actually ever develop any poor outcomes or life-threatening dysregulation as a result of that response to infection. And so that was not great validity. And they also found that a lot of patients who did in fact have aberrant responses to infections and very poor outcomes did not ever meet the SIRS criteria. And so they said, this really isn't a very valid system. And so we're going to throw out that term and also throw out the term sepsis syndrome, septicemia, and severe sepsis because they're all vague. And the reason that they thought this current validity was so poor for the SIRS criteria was that back in the early 90s, we thought that inflammatory excess was the main problem, whereas now we know that there is a more complicated system of activation of pro-inflammatory responses, anti-inflammatory responses, and then major modifications in non-immunologic pathways like the cardiovascular pathway, the autonomic pathway, and metabolic pathways. So we now have what's called the SOFA score. So this represents that organ dysfunction a little bit more globally. So SOFA stands for the Sequential Sepsis-Related Organ Failure Assessment Score. Again, you need two or more points, and having two or more points is associated with an in-hospital mortality of greater than 10%. Then you have septic shock if you have a SOFA score of two or more and need vasopressors. Briefly, the SOFA score is a 0 to 4 score for several categories. So there's the respiratory category, and there's PaO2 and FiO2 limits. There is a coagulation category with a platelet threshold, a liver category with a bilirubin threshold, a cardiovascular category with MAP goals, and then in 2, 3, and 4, the need for ionotropes or chronotropes, and then the central nervous system category with a Glasgow Coma Scale. And then the renal category has a creatinine score and a urine output score category.
And then the chapter finishes up on which fluids to give. And the first, my favorite part was, if they've lost a blood, if they're bleeding, think about giving them blood. Raise their hematocrit not higher than 35. And then there's a little bit on acellular blood substitutes. This sounds like a technology that has not moved forward since the last 20 years. I looked it up in Google and there was nothing there. Anybody have any game on acellular blood substitutes?
I feel like there's
no, just that we should all donate blood.
Good point. I think there's something that maybe we used in Jehovah's Witness patients. Let me look that up.
Those patients prefer prayer.
That's stop. What but really, I remember a patient that was really, really ill, and we were like, maybe we can get this like magical unicorn.
I was a resident, and we had a Jehovah's Witness that was bleeding, and they had a study. This was at in Rutgers, and they had a study going at, I think it was Hahnemann in Philly, where they had this blood substitute for Jehovah's Witnesses, some molecule that carries oxygen that's not red cells. And so they asked for a volunteer. They're going to fly her to Philly, and they asked for a volunteer to go on a helicopter. And I thought that would be a great idea. So I volunteered. And as we're getting on the helicopter, her IV falls out. We have no access. And I have to make a decision whether or not we're going to go or not. And so I just made a decision. Let's just go. Her blood pressure was stable, and thankfully she did okay. And we landed on the heliport, and they took her out like it was an episode of ER or something. It was pretty cool. And the only time I've ever ridden in a helicopter. So I don't know if that's the substance or not, but I don't know if those have gone anywhere. I don't know if they've really.
Joel, there was one sentence like early in this section here on the which fluid should be given, that they should be given rapidly under pressure through several intravenous catheters. I know we don't talk about this part ever, but like that, like thinking about the length of the catheter and the radius of the catheter, I think is important. So that's Poisson's law, or someone who actually speaks French could pronounce that right. But the idea is that the resistance that your fluid you're pushing through your catheter faces is proportional to the length of the catheter, and then inversely proportional to the radius to the fourth. And so the larger bore and the shorter, but particularly the larger bore your catheter, the better off you are in your resuscitation. And so really making sure you have some short, large bore access for patients is important in this like acute setting.
Yeah, I mean, if you go down to the ER and you see the trauma lines that they'll put in for patients that come in as traumas, they are short, they are wide bore IVs, and they are do not have a long line on them, as opposed to the kind of our triple lumens that we use, which have, you know, 6 meters of IV lines.
Of length, yeah. And a really tiny radius, yeah.
How did you guys like the military anti-shock trousers?
So I thought that was very interesting, obviously. And apparently, well, so obviously no one uses them. We never
carry our own special trousers.
Oh, I've heard of these before. I was excited about the trousers. Have you? So I wanted to talk about the trousers.
I looked up pictures of them. They look really interesting, actually. It's like got like a bunch of blood pressure cuffs up. Yeah. It's really cool. Anyway, I mean, I just like briefly read they're like kind of faded out of research use or whatever in the 1980s. I think they were developed in the 50s or 60s or something. So it's kind of a cool idea. It's like a Blakemore, but like on the outside. So
I remember reading about this for like fighter pilots who were going for like high G forces to like squeeze the blood back into their head. I don't know if that works or not, or people actually use that.
Dude, I'm the biggest compression stocking fanatic. Like this is what I want all my patients to have. It's like almost a tourniquet. Yes. Want it.
Yeah, but if you Google a picture of them, they're really kind of weird looking. I mean, that's they probably look probably why they cool, never took off. But
no one would wear them. Yeah. They're like, I'm not dying looking this stupid. Come on.
It was just a marketing problem in the end. Highly effective therapy, but they look stupid, so yeah. You don't use them. Okay.
It's an interesting I think all these are interesting though, because someone sat there and thought, if only we could somehow overcome the interstitial hydrostatic pressure, right? And they were like, how can we do that? Squeeze them. I love it. It's a great thought.
I mean, the idea is that it's auto transfusion, just pushing all the blood out of the legs. They don't need it that badly, and you'll have more circulatory volume for your brain. I'm surprised they fell out of favor. I also thought that was something for trauma.
You can still buy a pair. I think they're like $900.
I'm kind of surprised they don't have these.
You can find in the show notes.
If you get
our GoFundMe to buy Roger a pair of military anti-shock trousers, we'll start a campaign.
I won't wear them. It won't be pretty.
Well, if you ever get invited to the Met Gala, I think that would be the appropriate garb to wear.
I mean, I could see that being like a pilot wearing that. You know, like you just put your legs in, and then it's like a blood pressure cuff. Like if your Apple Watch shows that you're getting tachycardic, you know, it like cinches them down. Seriously.
Don't say seriously, because that was clearly not serious.
No, I'm almost not. I almost
almost serious. Almost. Okay. Is there anything else in this chapter that people wanted to talk about, or are we done?
I thought the rate of fluid replacement, that he was just like, I guess I should probably talk about that, and has like two sentences on how we don't care. As fast as you need
My
to.
My comment on that was it was a full paragraph with zero references.
As fast that as was, is
that
necessary.
That was just a pulled from the seat of his pants. Here, how about this? And-